Thank you. This is my third summer here doing these sessions with Hume. And if you were at the service this morning, how many were actually at the service? Wow, most of you. I think I recognize you two because you were sitting off to my right. Were you in the, service off to my right? Were you? Because I remember because you were really nodding at everything that I was saying. Like, oh, you got that one right. You got that one right. You got one. That's why I noticed you. I was sticking right there with you, focusing in on. To me, it's really an amazing thing, though, that I am standing anywhere in this campus and teaching because, like I said, 44 years ago, I was across the lake, and I was a camper at the campground over there, and my younger brother, Mark, had been beating on me for about a year about the Lord, and so he dragged me up here with the promise of some trout fishing, and I came up, and we did catch some trout. We didn't catch them in the lake. We bushwhacked the stream down below the dam. And we went after fish that nobody had ever seen before. And that's where I got my fish. And that's also where I got my poison ivy, or my poison oak, I guess, here on the West Coast. But I remember coming to that service. And then, to be honest with you, you know, he's dragging me in. He's going to get me saved there. And I didn't make all I remember is I wasn't interested in what was being said. I don't remember what the sermon was about. It was 44 years ago. And but so I just kind of wandered out halfway through. But 3 months later, the Lord got a hold of me. And that's when I became a follower of Christ in September of 1973. And it's been like having a tiger by the tail for 44 years. And you know what I'm talking about if you've been around for a while. And a lot of it's stuff I didn't anticipate, and I certainly never anticipated doing the kinds of things that I'm doing now. But I found that in the transformation of my life, what I saw God do in my own life, I wanted to see God do in other people's lives as well. And so I naturally started getting involved in evangelism, and because of my own personal interests or bent of mind, I also got involved in apologetics, which is defending the faith. And I was out in Westwood Village talking to people about Christ there at UCLA, and then people were pushing back with questions, as they do now. And so I want to try to figure out how to answer those things. And so this has began a whole lifelong quest for me as a follower of Christ. And ironically for me is that I thought I was too smart to be a Christian. That was my thing, you know. I thought Christians were either dumb or ugly. I mean, that's why they went to church, right? I know it sounds awful now when I think, but I thought you went to church because you couldn't get it socially accepted anywhere else. And so when you go to church, you got to love them. You know, it's on the wall, love one another. You know, it's like you have no choice. That's one of the rules, you know. And I figured that Christians couldn't do their own thinking for themselves, and so they had the pastor do their thinking for them, and that was my mindset. Now, since then, I've got a master's in philosophy under J.P. Moreland. I have discovered that Christianity has the richest tradition of rigorous thinking of any worldview. And if you look at Copleston's History of Philosophy, there's like 12 volumes. From the time of the ancients, I mean, from the time of Christ, all the way to about the 19th century, virtually every single name in there is a Bible-believing follower of Christ. I mean, the best thinking was coming from Christians. And so I was mistaken on both counts because all the wonderful people that I've met as a follower of Christ. And so that's why I think it's a little bit ironic, and I'm really thrilled to be able to try to pass some things on to other followers of Christ. Now, the theme of this week is, let me see if I get it right, the most encouraging messages you've never heard. Yeah. Is that right? Well, you know, in a sense, it kind of fits what I'm going to be talking about, you know, because the first three sessions, I'm going to focus on material that was a topic of a book that I wrote about 8 years ago or 9 years ago for Zondervan. It's called Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions, okay? And I'm going to pass on a tool to you that thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people have made use of. And I don't mean just in my own lecturing and talks, but that book has sold about 120,000 so far, and it's still moving really well for Zondervan, and I'm glad to see that because there is hardly a place that I go, and I mean this quite literally. This is not hyperbole. There's hardly a place that I go, and I do a lot of speaking, that I don't have somebody come up to me and tell me, you know that book, Tactics? That book changed my life. That's the language they use. That changed my life because there, and I'm going to talk about that, these first three sessions. So Sunday night, Monday night, and Tuesday night are connected. So if you come tonight, you're just getting a little piece of the pie. You don't come the next two nights, all right? So I'm going to encourage you to try to come for the duration, but especially these first three nights, because I'm going to give you three pieces to a puzzle that could change your life as well. And it's not because, in a certain sense, what I'm going to offer is that profound or even that clever. It's just doggone practical. And so I want to pass that on to you. And it may be, I don't know, but based on what people have said to me, it may be that those three sessions, you're going to look back on that and say, that's where it all changed for me. And what I mean where it all changed for me is what will change is your ability to engage in thoughtful, productive ways that are not harsh, angry confrontations. Conversations with other people about your convictions about Christ. And you will find, and this is what people have told me, because and it's also been true about my own life, that these kinds of engagements have become easier, more pleasant, and more productive as a result, okay? It's all because of the tactical approach. And I'll get into that in just a moment. Now, that's going to take us through Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Then on Wednesday night, I want to develop a little bit more an idea I just touched on this morning in the story of reality. And if that, by the way, if that piques your curiosity, I do want to commend the book to you. It just came out in January, January 6th, and it's available on Amazon. You could also get it at our website, str.org, Stand to Reason, STR. But it's actually cheaper on Amazon. So just I'm letting you know. Don't tell my staff I said that, okay? If you want to support us, buy it from us. If you want to just get it quick, Amazon Prime, push the button, one click, it'll be here in 2 days, you know? Even up here, they'll deliver, right? Yeah, every day the UPS truck comes up. So, but I hope you get that. But there was something that I mentioned this morning that I hope piqued people's curiosity in particular. And that was one, the problem of evil is not the problem that people think it is for Christianity. If you understand our story, it's not a problem. In fact, it's a solution. Christianity is a solution to that problem. There is strength in the problem when we get challenged by it. If you know how to use it, you show how it fits into our story. It can really be a plus in our side, okay? But what this also gets paired with is why Jesus is the only way of salvation. Now, sometimes as a speaker, you know, especially when you're going fast under a stopwatch, like I was this morning, you know, and I got like 60 minutes of stuff I'm supposed to do in 40 minutes, and sometimes you leave out a line that's really important, and I left out a line this morning, though I think it was implicit. I left out a line after I talked about the cross, God, man, Jesus, cross, that I needed to put in to make sense of something I said earlier about how understanding the big picture will allow you to see why Jesus is the only way of salvation. And the line I left out after I talked about Jesus making the trade to rescue us is that the reason Jesus is the only way of salvation is because he's the only one who solved the problem. He is the only way of salvation because he's the only way he's the only one who solved the problem, okay? Got to get the problem right before you can get the solution right, okay? Now, on Wednesday night, I'm just going to devote the whole talk to that question of why Jesus is the only way, and I will develop the notion a little bit more. And I'll also explain why it's not unusual to think. It shouldn't be unusual for anybody to think they get the right answer about these kinds of things, although now in our culture, this is considered brazen. It's considered intolerant, arrogant. The irony is all those people who are objecting have their own understanding of what the right answer is, and they all think they're right. But we're the only ones to get called names, okay? So I want to try to put that in perspective and give you a sense about how I maneuver with that question when I'm talking with a non-Christian. Okay, and I've spoken on more than 70 college and university campuses, so I've had a bit of exposure to the way they think, but I'll tell you, my heart is not in evangelism. My heart is in discipleship. My heart is in training other Christians, And this is why Stand to Reason as an organization has as its mission statement, we train Christians. That's the way it starts. To think more clearly and also to make a thoughtful, gracious, even-handed, and effective defense for classical Christianity and classical Christian values. So that's what we're all about. And that's really at the heart of what I'm going to offer the first 3 days. Then we'll cover that problem in the last night, Thursday night. I'm going to give a talk I give on campus a lot. And it's called Bad Arguments Against Religion. And basically the gist of it is there are a lot of ways that are, I think, legitimate ways to try to show that Christianity is false. If God doesn't exist, well, obviously, our story doesn't get started, right? Or if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, Paul himself said that we are most men to be pitied. It's in 1 Corinthians 15. People should feel sorry for us if we're believing in the resurrection contrary to fact, okay? So those, in a certain sense, are properly directed challenges to Christianity. Now, I don't think they go through. I don't think they succeed. Obviously, I'm a Christian. But at least they're shooting at the right target. However, there's a bunch of other things that are going around the marketplace that I consider bad arguments against God that can't get off the ground. And so when I speak to university audiences, I'm kind of saying, you know, if you want to go after Christianity and God, it's okay, I get it, I understand it, but don't make these mistakes because you'll just sound silly, okay? And in the process of doing that, I'm trying to really make the case for our side that there's that Christianity is worth thinking about, okay? Which is one of our little slogans at STR, Stand to Reason, Christianity worth thinking about, okay? So that's the agenda for this week. Now, I get a chance to speak at a lot of conferences where a lot of smart people are invited out, professors and PhDs, and I don't have a PhD, but a lot of guys I like to rub shoulders with, you know, and some of that's going to rub off on me, but they're doing their lectures and talks, and these are big events, and Friday night, all day Saturday, sometimes they're Thursday, Friday, and what happens at those events, and you might have been to some of those kinds of events, lots of great information, and we have a very, very deep bench. There is not a single challenge or objection that has come up that our team has not addressed aggressively and powerfully and persuasively. We got a lot of smart people on our team, I'm just telling you. But by the end of the conference, you know, people are getting a little weary. They're feeling a little overwhelmed by all that information. And they feel a little like that guy in the Far Side cartoon. You know, he's sitting in math class and there's all the equations on the board. And he raises his hand and he said, "Professor, could I please be excused? My brain is full." You know, that's the way people feel, you know, taking a drink out of a fire hydrant. And what they're thinking about is, how am I going to get all of this information, good stuff, how am I going to get it into play in a conversation with somebody? That's what I don't know. And so these conferences have a lot of good stuff that they offer, there's a problem with them. And the problem is something is missing. And the thing that's missing is a bridge from the content to the conversation, a bridge from the scholarship to the relationship. And much of the time, the reason they got me on the roster is I do the last plenary session and I give them in brief what I'm going to give in a little more expansive form in the next 3 evenings together. I give a bridge from the content to the conversation, okay? And before I get into that, though, I want to lay mostly tonight a little bit of a predicate for what I'm going to teach for these sessions. That is, I want to challenge you to view the project of evangelism, or what we characteristically call evangelism, in a different way, okay? So let me say something that is fairly controversial, and I've had a lot of people push back on what I'm about to tell you. But I'm going to stand behind it, and I think you'll see for good reason. But let me just say it, and then I'll explain it. I personally, Greg Kochel, never have it as a goal when I enter into a conversation that I hope will have a spiritual impact or lead to spiritual things, I never have it as a goal to lead that person to Christ. Now, do I want them to? By the way, I don't even have it as a goal necessarily to get to the gospel. Well, don't you want them to come to Christ? Of course I want them to come to Christ. Well, don't you need the gospel? Of course you need the gospel for that. Okay? The gospel is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, all right? But I want to tell you something about the culture. I became a Christian back in the Jesus movement, and in a certain sense, evangelism was easier then. You go out, you share Christ, you take a tract, you pray with somebody to receive Christ, and the Holy Spirit was moving a little bit. I mean, not a little bit, a lot, but different than now. A lot of opposition. Now, back then, it just seemed to be easier. People understood the message. They understood what you're talking about, and boom, you know, so you had some success, at least more than what in many cases we experience right now. But times have changed is what I'm saying, okay? And for one, the gospel, the simple gospel is not simple to people anymore. You express the simple gospel to them, they don't know what you're talking about. They hear the words, they recognize spiritual language, but for them, it is just spiritual noise. In fact, a lot of times, it's annoying noise. They're not understanding the substance of it, the kind of thing that I was trying to explain this morning. They don't get all that. All they hear is this religious noise, okay? And so the gospel is no longer simple. So you could say the right things that the words are true as far as they go if they're properly understood, but you're not communicating because they are not understood. We are at a time now that requires a lot of what more of what Francis Schaeffer used to call pre-evangelism, okay? Much more tilling, if you will, before the seed then can really take root. Another difficulty with the culture nowadays is that virtually every single way that Christianity can be challenged as being true is being challenged nowadays. You got the new atheists that are hammering away at the existence of God. You've got the Bible under serious attack. You have the existence of Jesus under attack. You have the notion of truth under attack. It's a full court press all the way around, and it's hardly a month goes by that there isn't a new bestseller that's going after Christianity. Now, it isn't that people are reading all these books. I mean, a lot of people are, but it isn't like everybody's reading it, but they know they're out there. And what they think, what they feel, the impression they get is the smart people have already weighed in against Christianity and found it wanting. So they're not inclined at all to think about it seriously because it's just off the radar for them. So that's the second problem that we're facing now in our culture. Here's the third problem, though. If I told you I was going to give you a game plan that would allow you to engage people in the sense that you share the gospel and lead them to Christ, you'd smile and take notes and say, praise the Lord, and then you wouldn't do it. And the reason you wouldn't do it is because the idea of bringing someone to a point of trying to confront them to accept the gospel, well, that sounds like conflict. And man, that makes you feel uncomfortable. And so what you think, you're not saying it out loud, but you're thinking, I'll let somebody else do that. I'm just gonna sit on the bench, you know, or I'm just gonna love them. You know, I just love people, which I think is good if you want to love people. That's all right. Being nice is really important in the gospel. But I want to tell you something. You will never be able to out-nice a Mormon. All right? So if that's your technique of evangelism, you got stiff competition. You got to get past the being nice part if you're going to make a difference. All right, that's kind of what I'm saying. So I understand this limitation, okay? And so as I began to think about this whole thing, you know, this problem that we have, it just in my own life and engaging the culture, I had a realization, and I don't know how long it was ago. It could have been 10 years ago, it could have been 15. My staff says, don't use numbers like how many years because you just sound senile. You know, I lose track of stuff so easily. So did I meet you last year? No, actually, I met a young lady. Is Rosie here? Is Rosie here? Oh, she did. Okay, well, Rosie came up to me and said, Greg. I said, wow, I recognized her right away. I didn't know her name. I couldn't remember that. I said, hey, it's good to see you. Wow, yeah. Are you the wife of that guy that I met like in the spring in Sacramento, Daniel? No, I'm Rosie from Hope Chapel. I was at Hope Chapel like 30 years ago. Right, so like I completely, you know, so I don't, but whatever, it was maybe 10 to 20 years ago, I had a realization. Okay, now I want you to write this down because this is really key for me, and I think getting this point that I want to make, that is a change of perspective about how we go about what we call evangelism. Okay, here was the insight. Before there can be any harvest, there always has to be a season of, let's just call it gardening. Before there can be any harvest, I mean, whether it's in a big giant community like Revival or in individual life, which is mostly what we're facing now, before any individual can be harvested for the Lord, there's got to be a season of gardening in their life. Almost nobody becomes a Christian like overnight. They go from 0 to 60 in 24 hours. That doesn't happen. Now, it could, and occasionally God can do whatever he wants, but that's not the way it works. There's got to be a longer season. And it seems to me our mentality is harvest mode. So we're witnessing to get decisions out of the individual we're witnessing to, and that's harvest mode. What if that person isn't in harvest stage? What if the fruit isn't ripe yet? Well, see, now you're spinning your wheels a little bit if you're trying to harvest fruit that's not ready to harvest. Let me tell you something about agriculture. This is pretty straightforward. It's not a big, deep insight. When the fruit is ripe, it falls from the tree, like that. I became a Christian September 28, 1973. My brother, who had been plowing a lot of ground with me, came up to my apartment that particular night. It was a Friday night, and he started to witness more with me. And I said, Mark, you don't have to tell me anything more about Jesus. I'm ready to become a Christian. Boom, what happened? He bumped up against the tree. The fruit just fell into the basket. I was ripe. I was ready. I learned how they harvest cherries. By the way, it's the same way they harvest almonds down the hill. You know, I figured, how can anybody make any money selling cherries? You know, we got a bag of them in our room. Been eating them. $3.95 at the grocery market. I said, $3.95 for this big bag? How can anybody make any money on that? You know, it takes forever. Okay, then I found out how they harvest cherries. They don't pick cherries. They drive down the row with a big truck. They put a little mechanical arm around the thing, and they shake the tree. And all the cherries fall into a big tarp, and they roll down into a basket. When the fruit is ripe, it falls right off, right? When I found that out, I thought, they're charging too much for cherries. So this is the point here, you know. Once the gardening has been done and the harvest is ready, the harvest is easy, okay? But if our mentality is harvest, 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 sometimes we're shaking trees that doesn't have any ripe fruit. And that's what people are upset about. They're uncomfortable about. And so I started thinking about my own life, and I look back on my professional life. 24 years now would stand to reason, 26 or 27 years now in radio. I've got seven books. I lose count. I start sounding senile when I do those numbers, you know. And I realize as I look back on my activity, I'm a gardener. I've been gardening most of the time. That is, there are very few people that I sit down with and pray to receive Christ. Frankly, I can't even remember the last time I did that. But I fairly consistently get people who call and let me know that through the process of me being involved in their life, they listen to the podcast, they read the books, they eventually became Christians. I'm gardening, 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 gardening. Now, I thought about it, you know. If ripe fruit falls into the basket, well, the easy part is the harvesting. The harder part is the gardening. That is, you probably need, listen, more gardeners than you need harvesters. If the hard part isn't the gardening, the easy part is the harvest when the fruit is ripe. Well, you probably need more gardeners than harvesters. Well, that made sense in my life. Oh, I'm just gardening. But I wonder if you've thought about this. Maybe you're not a harvester. Maybe you're a gardener. and you didn't know it. Okay? And when I started thinking about that in my own life, I started changing my approach to the whole enterprise. Instead of going for the gold, that is, or, you know, mix my metaphors, instead of like swinging for the fences, you know, trying to get the score, when I'm talking to people, engaging people about the Lord, I lowered my goal. Instead of thinking about harvesting, I thought about gardening. And incidentally, I don't know if you notice this, Paul mentions in Corinthians about, you know, I planted, Apollos watered, God causes the increase. So that's a verse that kind of fits in with what I'm saying. But I discovered John chapter 4, the woman at the well, Jesus talks about the same thing. Because after he's done talking to the woman at the well, she goes to Sychar and the disciples come and he says to the disciples, you are about to reap where you did not sow. In other words, somebody else did the heavy lifting for the gardening and they get to pluck the low-hanging fruit, you know? It's going to be easy for them. And then he says, so notice how there's one field, but there are two seasons. There's gardening and there's reaping, and there's two kinds of workers. And then he says, so that the one who sows and the one who reaps can rejoice together. Wow, that's great. Now, do you think after I'm doing all this gardening, somebody comes into my garden and plucks the fruit that's ripe, you think I'm going to say, get out of my garden. I'm the one who's gardening here. Don't you harvest that fruit. No, you want to come into my garden and you harvest, come on down. We're all on the same team. We're just doing different jobs. That's the point Jesus was making there, and that's kind of the point I'm making here. And so this realization then began to modify my whole approach to evangelism, which I think more in terms of being an ambassador, not an evangelist now. Because I want my engagements to look more like diplomacy than D-Day, okay? When I got to thinking about that, I changed my goal. Now, whenever I speak to a non-Christian audience, I always tell them what my goal is. Last was at University of Hawaii, and was that April I was there, honey? Because my wife met me after work. I went there early and did some work. Anyway, here's how I start. Here's how I address the audience. Every time, no matter what I'm speaking about, this is my introduction to myself in the evening. I'm here tonight, I tell them, because my life has been deeply changed by an ancient teacher. His name is Jesus of Nazareth. And 40 years or 44 years ago now, when I was a student at UCLA, I tell them, I began to think more carefully about the claims that Jesus made about himself, the claims he made about the world, story of reality, and the claim that he made on my own life. And after thinking about it a lot and pushing back a bit, asking a lot of questions, I finally came to the conclusion that Jesus got it right, that he saw the world the way it really was, and then the smart money, I realized, is on Jesus. And so I decided to step in behind him and to follow him. And I've been doing that for almost 44 years, and it's not been easy, I tell the audience. I said, but it's been real. It's reality, okay? However, I tell them, I'm not here tonight to convert you. You can hear a collective sigh of relief. I have a more modest goal, I tell them. I said, I just want to put a stone in your shoe. I just want to annoy you in a good way. And then they all usually start chuckling because they expect the Christian to annoy them, right? And I say, okay, I'm your guy, but you'll thank me when I'm done. I want you walking out of here thinking about something I said. Now, I don't know what it's going to be, friends. I don't know what it's going to be in my whole lecture, but I want something to stick them a little bit. And so they're walking out of there, hobbling along on that stone, thinking about Christianity and about Jesus. Listen, if I can do that, if I could just slip a stone in their shoe, I'm happy. That's my goal. So what am I saying? I'm saying all I want to do is a little bit of gardening. I'm not trying to win them to Christ. I want them to come to Christ, but I'm not thinking about this big giant goal that I'm shooting for that may discourage me from being involved at all. You see the point here. If I think, well, maybe I could just do a little gardening, pull a weed or two here, you know, move a stone, do a little disking or something, get them thinking, well, I'm just part of a bigger team, right? And I can do my little part, and if you are doing your part, God is going to move this whole process forward until that individual is ready to be harvested. And I don't, maybe I'll be there, maybe somebody else will be there, but I'm really happy to be a gardener. Okay, so this now is a perspective that I want you to consider. Now, like I said, some people don't like this perspective. They like to go for the gold, and those are usually the harvester types. You know, the hardcore harvester types, they don't like what I just said. They think I'm giving you an easy out, making it too easy, you know. No, we got to go for it. Okay, you know, then if that's your deal, then do it. But that's not everybody's deal. We all got a part. It's one field. It's one team. Two kinds of workers, but we're all in it together. So different people do different jobs. Now, I got something, though, that probably you don't have. What I have is a game plan. And what I want to promise you for the next three nights, if you don't come all three nights, you know, can't fulfill the promise. But if you come, I think you'll see that I made good my word. I promise you that I will give you a game plan that will allow you to converse with confidence in any situation, no matter how little you think you know, and you may not know much, or no matter how knowledgeable or aggressive or even obnoxious the other person happens to be. Okay, that's my pledge. Now, I've made this pledge many, many times before, and I've made good on the pledge, giving you the game plan. This is the game plan, by the way, that follows something in the book of Colossians, a directive that Paul offers. Here's what he says. It's Colossians chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. Here's what Paul says. Conduct yourself with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Okay, that's a good start. In other words, he's saying, be smart. All right? Then he says, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt. So he says, first be smart, then he says, be nice. What a concept, right? And then he ends, so that you know how to respond to each person. In other words, people are individuals. He says, be smart, be nice, but be tactical. And that's where the game plan comes in. So let me give you an example of how this works. My wife and I and my daughters, we just got back from Wisconsin on Monday. And we have a place up there that's been in my family since the early 60s, and now it's my responsibility to take care of. But I love going up there. It's the North Country, and I like to bass fish when I can get out, which isn't too often, but I fish out there. Although this last time we had really bad weather, so I didn't get out too much. But anyway, this particular year, and it was before we had kids, I mentioned this morning I got a 12 and a 9. But I went out with a local pastor, and I caught the largest smallmouth bass of my life. I'm a bass fisherman, and I fish for smallies up there. Now, that fish was 4 pounds, 3 ounces. That's a pretty big smallie for that neck of the woods. I was really proud of that fish. Now, I just got to tell you, though, since then, I got 8 fish over 5. I'm just saying, okay? 8 over 5, 1 5-13. That's, man, if that fish, that 5-13 would have ate another crawdad, I would have had a 6-pounder, you know, but in any event, I was really proud of that fish, and so I wanted to take the film to the local film film. Film, F-I-L-M, that's like the stuff that we used to use, and you had to take it in, you take a picture, and I was getting it digitized so I could show it up on the screen at the pastor's church the following week where I was supposed to teach. I wanted to flex my fishing muscles. These people care about that thing up there in the North Woods, you know. So my wife and I, together, we dropped the film, that stuff, that film thing, off at a local overnight film place. There's a young lady standing there at the counter, and she was processing our order. She had a large pentagram hanging from her neck. Now, a pentagram is a five-pointed star, okay? And it's often, not always, but it's often an occultic symbol. And this was a big one, so it looked like a statement. And so I asked her, I said, did that jewelry have religious significance? And she said, yes, it does. The 5 points stand for God, man, Jesus Christ. No, not. I never did that joke before. I probably will never do it again either because it didn't go over very well. The 5 points stand for earth, wind, fire, water, and spirit. So now the bells are going off, you know, this is occult stuff. I said, well, you know, I really wanted to know whether it had spiritual significance to you personally, because a lot of people wear a cross, and it doesn't mean anything to them. It's just jewelry, you know. And so she said, yes, it does. I'm a pagan, is what she said. Oh, my dear wife who's sitting over there, she's standing next to me, you know, and I'm a trained professional, right? Well, when my wife heard this young lady call herself a pagan, it caught her by surprise, and she started laughing. And then she caught herself really quickly, and she said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be rude, but I never heard anybody admit it before. That's what she said. She'd only heard the word pagan when her girlfriends would call her kids in. Get in here, you bunch of pagans, you know, that kind of thing. Well, the gal wasn't offended. She said, well, you know, it's a kind of a earth religion, and she went on to explain a little bit about it. And as she's explaining the details, I realize I'm talking to a witch. And so I asked her, I said, are you a Wicca? And she said, yes, I am. And then she went on to describe how in her belief system, they respect all life. This is a core element of their theology. We respect all life. I said, wow, that's great. That would probably make you pro-life then on the abortion issue. So are you pro-life? She says, no, actually, I'm pro-choice. I said, really? Isn't it kind of odd for a witch to be pro-choice? That's what I asked her, because that's my understanding. And she said, yeah, it is kind of weird. And then she said this. Now, listen. She said this. She said, I could never do that, referring to abortion. I could never kill a baby. Those were her words. Now, at Stand to Reason, we have training material on the issue of abortion, Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion, all right? And we use philosophic and moral and ethical and scientific arguments against abortion. We don't use the Bible because most of the people you talk to they don't care what the Bible says, okay? But in any event, we make the case that abortion takes the life of an innocent human being without proper justification, a valuable human being. I hinted at that earlier today. And a baby killing, if you will. I mean, I think that's an accurate description. But we don't encourage people to use that language when they're trying to make their case because we don't want to be accused of using loaded rhetoric to make our case. We want to offer a good, sound argument, okay? But in this particular case, I'm not the one using the baby killing language to describe abortion. It is the person who is actually pro-abortion who's using that language. And so if you don't remember anything else from tonight, I hope that you remember the importance of listening to what other people say. This is really, really key. Listening to what they say, because other people are going to give you information you need to know how to progress in your conversation. She had just given me a piece of information. She is acknowledging that abortion is killing a baby. Now, she's in favor of it, which is in principle. She wouldn't do it, but she's in favor of it in principle. And so now I've got something to work with here. She said, I could never do that. I could never kill a baby. And then she gave the reason why. She said, I wouldn't want something bad to come back on me. Oh, I'm chuckling here because that strikes me as an odd reason not to kill a baby. You know, you can't start killing babies. You never know what's going to happen to you if you start doing that. You know, it's like a what goes around comes around thing. But I didn't pursue that. I just left that lie. I said, okay, well, maybe you won't kill babies, but maybe we should stop other people from killing babies. That's what I said to her. And she said, well, I think people should have a choice. What is the choice that we're talking about here? Explicitly now, the choice to kill babies. And that's what I said to her. You mean people should have the choice to kill babies? And she said, well, I think everything should be taken into consideration. I said, okay, what would be a consideration that make it okay to kill a baby? And she immediately said incest. Okay, now listen, you know what's going on here? She's just repeating all of the pro-choice slogans. The problem in her case, in this circumstance, is she has already identified abortion as baby killing, And so all of the slogans in favor of choice are now explicitly slogans in favor of killing babies. And it's starting to sound a little bit weird. But she doesn't hear it in her ear because she's not paying attention to what she's saying. She's just running out the slogans. People do this all the time, and Christians do it too. We start sloganeering instead of thinking and communicating. And this got her into a fix because I was thinking and I was paying attention. And so I said, let me ask you a question. If I had a 2-year-old standing next to me who had been conceived by incest, then on your view, I should be allowed to kill that baby. Is that right? Now, let me ask you, is that a fair, legitimate application of her view? What do you think? Yeah, I think it is. And guess what? If it wasn't, I am giving her an opportunity to correct me. But she didn't correct me because it was a fair application of her view. And it was meant to show her in kind of a friendly way that her view is pretty bizarre. And when I said that, she stopped and she started thinking. And I don't know if that's when I put a stone in her shoe or not. It's hard to tell about these things. God knows. We don't always know. We do the best we can. We garden around a little bit and then we let God worry about it. Okay? It's our task. It's God's problem. All right? It's our task. Evangelism is our task. It's God's problem. It's not my problem. Okay? It's God's problem. He's got to worry about that. So I'm just doing what I can do. And then... So she's pausing now, thinking about it for a few seconds. And then she says about killing the 2-year-old who had been conceived by incest. I fulfill her requirement, right? And then she says, I'd have mixed feelings about it. I hope they're at least mixed, you know. But she was making a concession. You got me thinking there, you know. Now, I noticed that the line is beginning to build behind me. And I am interfering with her work product now. So I realize, watch this, that my opportunity has come to an end. Now, had I been of a different persuasion about the whole project, if I had had the conviction that it's not legitimate unless I get to the gospel in every conversation, I might have said, hey, folks, sorry, I haven't got to the gospel yet. Sit down. Listen up. Might learn something. But see, I wasn't under that pressure. You know, sometimes people say, well, look at your system. I'm going to explain. When do you get to the gospel? You ever get to the gospel? Yeah, I do. When do you get the gospel? Here's when I get to the gospel. Here's my rule. I get to the gospel whenever I want. Now, I know that sounds a little cheeky, but the point is I do not feel artificially forced by some evangelistic rule to get to the gospel in every conversation when it doesn't fit. Jesus didn't get to the gospel in every conversation, for goodness sake. A lot of times he got to the bad news and he stopped. He let the bad news just sit there. You know, I had one person who was a Christian, but he said I had heard that when I was non-Christian, I'd heard that the gospel meant good news. And so I read the gospels and I didn't find any good news in there. I just kept finding bad news. It's a good insight, by the way. You know, so I don't have the feel the compulsion to get to the end game if it doesn't fit in with good communication, okay? If it doesn't meet the need of the moment. So I try with the best judgment I have to give what I think is appropriate in the moment and then leave the rest to God. Okay? And so that's why I didn't get there. Sometimes people say, well, why'd you talk about abortion? Why'd you choose that? I said, I didn't really choose it. I was just following the lead of the circumstances. I was taking the opportunity that was given me, and I was making the best use of it that I could, and then let God take care of the rest. So we just left it. My wife and I, we went in a grocery shopping afterwards, and I think we went out in the car. We prayed for this young lady, the witch in Wisconsin. And I took a bunch of notes, actually, because I didn't want to forget what had been said. Because I thought it would be pretty good material for a talk, you know, or something. I mean, passing these things on. And if you don't write it down, you know, then you start getting evangelistic, you know, you start exaggerating particulars. But that's the way it really took place. It's abbreviated a little bit. But, and I want you to notice something about that conversation. In that conversation, I asked 9 different questions. I asked questions to open up the conversation. I asked her about her jewelry. I ask questions to get more information about our own convictions. I ask questions to maybe exploit what I thought was a weakness or a flaw. And that's when I use the example of the two-year-old there. And then in my notes, which I don't even have, here they are right here somewhere. I'll open them up later. In my notes it says, and she was doing all the work. Actually, the original one says she was doing most of the work, which means I was doing some of the work, but she was doing the lion's share. And I realized I wasn't doing any work. I was just relaxed, just having a conversation. It wasn't hard for me. I was following my game plan. Simple. No stress on my side. She was doing all of the work. I changed my notes. Then I thought about it. I thought, well, she wasn't working either, for goodness sake. Because there was no fight. There were no lines drawn in the sand. Our dukes weren't up. We weren't defending turf. I don't want that kind of thing. Once people start defending, man, you forget about it. It's over with. Here's a little rule. You can think about this, okay? If I'm in a conversation with somebody and I get mad, you know that happens, right? If I get mad, I lose. Write that down. If I get mad, I lose. What if I don't get mad? What if I'm in a conversation because the way the conversation goes, the other person gets mad, but I don't get mad? Okay, add this to it. If the other person gets mad, I lose. How about this? If anybody gets mad, I lose. Right? And you're thinking, why didn't you say that first? And I don't have to write those other sentences down. This, by the way, is a good principle for marriage. If anybody gets mad, I lose. And I'm really being courageous now because I'm saying that with my wife sitting right over there. But that's a freebie. I'm just giving you that on the side. But it really is appropriate in engaging people about the claims of Christ. We don't want to get people angry if we can possibly avoid it. Now, Jesus, did he get some people angry? Yeah, he did. You know, got himself killed, for goodness sake. So you can't always avoid it. You want people to be angry for the right reasons. And being obnoxious is not one of the right reasons, right? Okay, so that is what I've just described in that illustration is the advantage of using a tactical approach. Tactics makes all the difference. What time am I supposed to be finished? What time? 7? 7? 8? 8:15? 8:15. Okay, good. All right, good.
A little later. We've got to get out of Huckleberry.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Good. Got more time. Now, stand to reason, I've written this book, and I'm really hey, look, you got the story of reality. Oh, my, this man has my book from, oh, man.
I'm actually reading it.
God bless your heart.
I did just bring it.
I saw there was a glow about you. There was just something that was different. And look at, see, he's like 80% through. He's got an 80% glow. You know, when you finish this, you're just going to be really fabulous. But I did not bring the tactics book, which I should have. Unless somebody's got it, you can hold it up. But I didn't bring the tactics book. But you can get that on Amazon, too. And the tactical approach we teach at Stand to Reason, and there's lots of different tactics that we teach, and it's all in the book. They have names like Steamroller and Just the Facts, Ma'am, and Road Scholar and Taking the Roof Off and Suicide. And these are all maneuvers that you can learn to use in conversation that will make your communication of the gospel and the truth more effective, okay? But there is one tactic that is actually, I call it the queen mother of all tactics because it is the tactic that represents the game plan itself, okay? And it's the simplest tactic imaginable to stop a challenger in their tracks, to turn the tables, and to get them thinking. And the tactic has a name, and the name of the tactic is Columbo. As in the infamous Lieutenant Columbo, who... Now, I said somewhere, it's like 20 years ago, it was like more like 40 years ago he's on TV, but he's the most recognized TV icon of all time. He even beat out Lucy, if you can imagine that. You know, he shows up on the crime scene, there's a dead body, he's wearing this trench coat, it looks like he slept in it like mine does. I got mine at Salvation Army. My wife is a thrift store queen, you know, and she told me a long time ago, you should always, whenever you buy something, you always check the pockets because you never know what you're going to... Wait a minute, what's this? Oh my gosh, look at that! It's a cigar! Columbo always had a cigar, right? Now look, don't worry about it. This is plastic. No worries, all right? I actually hate cigars. Whenever I find a real cigar, I always destroy it by fire. All the way, man. I don't want anybody to stumble, so I make sure that's gone, right? All right, so now you also got a pad of paper. He can't use the paper, though. Why can't he use the paper? Because he doesn't have a pen or pencil, right? He's got to bum a pen off of somebody. And he shows up at the crime scene, and he's scratching his head, and he's wandering around like this, muttering to himself, this guy doesn't look like he can think his way out of a wet paper bag. I mean, this guy is stupid, but he's stupid like a fox because he's got a plan. And at some point, he'll pause, and he'll put his fingers to furrowed brow like his deep and painful thought, and he'll say something like this. I don't know. There's something about this thing that bothers me. Do you mind if I ask you a question? And he asks the question, right? Gets the answer back. You're very intelligent. One more thing. And then he one more tings him to death, right? With question after question after question. Sometimes he even get upset. And he says, I'm sorry. It's because I'm asking all these questions, but I can't help it. It's a habit. And this is a habit that you ought to get into. The key to the Columbo tactic, which is the key to the game plan, is that the Christian goes on the offensive in an inoffensive way with carefully selected questions that advance the conversation. Okay, let me say this again. The Christian goes on the offensive in an inoffensive way with carefully selected questions that advance the conversation. Okay, why questions? Well, for one, questions are good manners. You know, when you draw somebody out with questions, you are showing an interest in that person. When you show an interest in that person, that makes them feel better, okay? So using questions to draw somebody out is just a nice way of being friendly, okay? Not only that, though, questions are, when you ask questions, you're going to get valuable information, okay? You're going to get information about that person, about what they think about things if you ask the right questions, where they are, what they understand spiritually, all kinds of things like that. But most important about, and you can even use questions to exploit weakness or flaw. You can use questions to make a point if you know how to do it. But the most important thing is that questions put you in the driver's seat of the conversation. Okay? Questions put you in the driver's seat of the conversation, and that's the key to the tactical approach. You want to be in the driver's seat. Does this mean you're doing all the talking? No, it doesn't mean you're not doing most of the talking, actually. In my system, in my game plan, the other person's doing more talking, but you are guiding the conversation. Look, I've been 27 years or whatever I said in radio. I lose track of that. And so I'll do interviews with authors on occasion. And my goal is to use the author's doing most of the talking, but that if I'm doing my job properly, that interview is going in the direction I want it to go because of the questions that I ask. So the questions control the conversation. Now, it's not manipulation. It's not inappropriate kind of control. It's not coercion. It's just management, and this is where you want to be. The tactical approach is not about manipulating people. It's about being in the driver's seat of the conversation and making the most effective use of the opportunities that you have, okay? Doing a little gardening when you're able, trying to put a stone in someone's shoe to get them thinking about things that really matter. And if you can do a little bit of that, well, when I do it, I'm satisfied. So I'm suggesting that as a goal to you. And the means to accomplish that is the tactical approach. And the core of the game plan, the Columbo tactic, is using questions to move forward. Now, the Columbo tactic has three different uses, okay? Three different uses. So this represents the core of your game plan. So once you got the idea of what I'm describing here, you modified your goal to put a stone in someone's shoe, do a little gardening. How do we do that? We got one, two, three. We've got three different steps. And when you start out, all you have to do is worry about the first one. You don't have to worry about the second one. You don't have to worry about the end game, okay? I got interviewed a number of years ago, right after the book came out, the tactics book came out, by Jim Dobson's son, Ryan Dobson. This guy's a real live wire. I don't know if you know anything about this guy, but he's like ADD to the absolute max, man. He's just totally amped up. And so we're talking for about half an hour about this tactic. And then he says, well, what's the end game? Now, I hadn't said anything about the stone in the shoe or whatever. He said, what's the end game? And he's thinking classical, you know, pray to receive Christ. I said, well, I just want to get him thinking. I just want to put a stone in a shoe. He could not believe that. You can think of imagine the environment of the fundy kind of environment that he grew up in. I'm not putting that down, but it's very, you know, it's and for him to hear, you know, it's okay not to get to the end game, go for the gold every time around. It's okay. You can do some gardening. This was unbelievably liberating for him. And if I thought he was amped up before I said that, this guy went into outer space. It was really something. And he said, I cannot wait to get out again and start talking to people about the Lord using this approach, because he saw immediately the value of it, the energy, the capability of it to move things forward in a much more productive kind of fashion. So I'm going to give you over the next 3 days these three uses of Columbo, and give you enough information that you can begin to employ it. Each of these uses have a different kind of question. In fact, the first two uses of Columbo have a very specific question that will launch it, okay? And I'll give you that question. And the third use of Columbo does not have a specific question. It's germane to the individual circumstance. So that's where it's a little more advanced. You're going to have to work with that yourself and figure out, okay, how does this situation apply for this question, for circumstance? What question can I use? I'll walk you through that a little bit so that you can get the sense of it. But tomorrow night, what I want to do is I want to go through in much more detail the use of the first question, then the use of the second question, and then on Tuesday night, I'll go through the third use of Columbo. Oh, sorry. How'd that happen? Can you see where that went?
Yeah.
Oh, there it is. Okay. Does that work? There we go. We're back in business. That was weird. So let me just go back over what I've covered so far this evening, okay? Let's just revisit it. I started off by making a kind of general promise, and that was that this could be what you learn in the next 3 days could change everything, be a whole new way of approaching the project of engaging other people about your convictions, all right? And then I invited you to step back from the process and rethink it a little bit, because we have inherited a kind of close the deal approach, I think largely from the Jesus movement, but maybe before that. I don't know, I wasn't around before that in Christianity, so I couldn't tell you. But certainly that was a big emphasis. And I think that works against the process for most people nowadays, because the world has changed. The gospel is no longer simple. There's a lot of obstacles in the road. And plus, for most people, the idea of trying to go out and challenge people to receive Christ is so frightening to them, they don't even want to get started, so they sit on the bench. And so what I did is I suggested an alternative, an alternative goal. And my goal was just that, as I described, to try to do a little gardening. Because before the harvest in anybody's life, there's always got to be a season of gardening. And suggested to you that you might be a gardener, not a harvester. And if you've only thought in harvest mode, you've probably been frustrated. And maybe now's the time to think more of gardening, doing a little bit here, a little bit there, and being part of a larger team as God himself oversees the project. And I mentioned that my goal is to just put a stone in people's shoe. If I can do that, I'm happy. If I go further, fine, as long as the door is open to do that. But a lot of times you don't have such a big opportunity, but you can do a little bit. But I said the important thing is to have a game plan to accomplish that. That makes all the difference. And The game plan that I'm offering you is a game plan, a tactical approach that uses questions to allow you to do what Paul said in Colossians 4, verse 5 and 6. Be smart, be nice, be tactical. Try to treat people as individuals. And when this whole thing starts moving for you, I think, and you start employing it, you will be able to talk, converse with anybody, no matter how little you know, or how knowledgeable or aggressive or even obnoxious the other person happens to be. And you'll see how that plays out here in the next couple of days. So I've just got about 5 minutes to go here. I thought maybe I'd just give you an opportunity to ask a question or two or three about some things I've said here, points of clarification, get you involved a little bit. Yeah.
You mentioned the concept of listening, which probably will lead you to the next question.
Yeah.
Does that come easy? Not the listening part, but does the development of the following questions come easier with practice?
Yeah, it does. The question is, okay, we listen, we ask a question, then we listen. Okay, now what? What happens next? Does the next step come more easily with practice, the gentleman is asking? And the answer to that is absolutely. It comes a lot easier. But if you learn to listen, I mean, it's actually easier than you think. If you learn to listen, especially if you're talking about spiritual things, people have massive ambiguities in the things that they say about religion. They make claims. They make assertions. They raise objections. But there's all kinds of ambiguities there. So there are many of opportunities to get clarification of their use questions to get clarification. And some of the questions are going to come very naturally based on what they've said. Okay. Other times you may have to think through it a little bit more, but it is definitely the case that this can become much more second nature once you practice it. It's not that hard.
The clarification questions I seem to be able to do well, but the idea of directing it in a manner in such as you would prefer the conversation to go,
That would be the third use of Columbo, because in the first two uses, you're really gathering two different kinds of information. Excuse me, and I'll tell you more detail about it. Are you familiar with the tactical?
No.
Oh, okay, because the clarification question, that's part of the package. I thought maybe you had been familiar with it, but we're gathering two different kinds of information with the first two questions, okay? The third use of Columbo, we're actually, you know, give you a heads up on it, we're using Columbo to make a point. We're using questions to make a point. And sometimes you're going to use questions to kind of advance your own point of view, but you get the other person involved in the process by the way you question them to make the point that you want to make. Or you can use questions to set up a circumstance where you are going to exploit a weakness or a flaw, just like I did with the witch in Wisconsin. So if I understand you correctly, if I have a 2-year-old standing here next to me who had been conceived by incest, then on your view, I should be allowed to kill that child. Now, that's actually the taking the roof off tactic, using questions to employ it. So that's another part of the book, but I'm using questions to employ that tactic. I'm using questions to exploit a weakness or a flaw, and I'm exploiting it using a particular kind of tactic. Okay? You don't need to know the other tactic thing. I'm just saying that sometimes in this third use, you've got to do some more thinking about how you're going to exploit that weakness or flaw. You got to see the flaw, and then you've got to exploit it. But in two nights, I'll tell you all about that. I'll share how that all plays out. Okay. So, and then if you have more questions after that, you're welcome to ask them. Anybody else? Yeah.
Are you intending to put a stone in their shoe about their worldview or your worldview?
Both, actually. She asked this good question. Took me a moment to. Okay. Oh, I get it. Are you intending, she said, to put a stone in their shoe about their worldview or about my worldview? And that, both and either or, depending on the circumstances. So with the witch in Wisconsin, that illustration I just gave, I want to stick her with her view. Oh, this is what your view leads to. So on your view, I can kill this baby. Ah, that doesn't sound so good, does it? Oh, no, it got me thinking about that. Okay, good. Good. Now, other times I'm going to try to put a stone in people's shoe about my worldview. So today I gave the illustration of the trade. I talk about the trade. Now, in theological terms, I was talking about substitutionary atonement and justification. That's what the trade is. It's the marvelous, well, what's the phrase? Now I can't think of it. The Reformers use the marvelous exchange. Jesus took our sin, we take his righteousness, okay? Well, notice how I sidestep all the theological language and I've just tried to use a more clear characterization. I called it the trade, okay? Well, I'm trying to stick somebody too. I'm trying to get, just like that gal, the Muslim woman sitting next to me, you know? I want her to see something about my worldview. Here's what we can do for you. Allah can't do this. Muhammad, he didn't do this. Jesus did this. Allah came down. Jesus said, take me instead. So there's a stone. That's a big stone. I mean, what I mean is a big stone. It's a big important thing. And I think it's said, the illustration or the way that's put is pretty compelling. People may have not heard that before. They say, well, Jesus died in your place or substitutionary atonement or Jesus died for you or he died for your sins. And all these things are accurate, but they do not communicate with the kind of poignancy, I think, as that illustration that I used with that woman. Okay, and that's why I use it in the talk, because I think a lot of Christians don't get the pow impact of that. Take me instead. That's Isaiah 53, by the way. I didn't read that today because I didn't have time. But I read a chunk of Isaiah 53, you know. He took the strokes that were due us. Powerful, you know, 700 years before, it was all prophesied. So there's a stone I'm trying to put in people's shoe with regards to my own view. So depending on the circumstances, I'm going both ways. Good question. Anybody else? Well, in 1 minute, we got to kid our kids from Huckleberry or whatever the thing is called. So this is a good time to end. Let me end with a prayer here tonight, and then I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Lord, thank you for this.